This episode is brought to you by Cart Driver, Denver's home for wood-fired pizzas, fresh oysters, seasonal market plates, cocktails, and conversation.
I'm Brian Kenny, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, they've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is James Molesworth. We'll talk to James about a lot of things, including Cali Cabs, Bordeaux, the Rhone, Loire, Port. Talk about Wine Spectator, wine, and a lot more. We got a lot to talk about. During the show and for our weekly wine sip, we're going to taste a few wines, a Cali Pinot, and James brought in an interesting white from California, too. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. All right. Native New Yorker James Molesworth was surrounded by wine growing up. After graduating college, he took a job at a famed New York retailer specializing in Burgundy. He moved to the restaurant side as a cellar master and eventually sommelier at the legendary 21 Club. James joined Wine Spectator in 1997 as a tasting coordinator and was elevated to senior editor in 2004. He became a regular taster in 2000, and his tasting beat covers recently Cali Cabs, Bordeaux, the Rhone, Loire, Port, and South African wines. Did I leave anything out?
A couple little things. The Finger Lakes. That pretty much covers it, yeah.
Long Island? No.
Long Island, I've done. Sherry, a couple other things.
All right, so welcome to the show, James.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming in. Before we get started, give our audience a little background on your journey in life and wine that pretty much gets us to current, which is at the Wine Spectator right now.
Yeah, well, born in Flushing, Queens, and grew up in Forest Hills. Luckily, no New York accent. I keep it pretty clean.
Pretty good.
Yeah. Went to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and got an anthropology degree.
Perfect.
Yep. And fell in love with jazz music there. Was actually on the radio, hosted the radio show there, and ran the college radio station, which was a blast. And I came back to New York, and of course, I needed a job. And for some reason, a BA in anthropology and a love of jazz music got me absolutely nowhere. So I took a job in a wine shop because I'd been living at home with my parents for a couple weeks at that point after finishing college. And that had already worn thin, so it was time to get out and get on my own.
Right.
And in fact, my dad was an English professor. He was colleagues with the wife of Steve Tanzer back then.
Well-known
so he,
wine.
Yeah, he put in a call to Steve Tanzer, and he put in a letter of recommendation for me when I applied for basically a cellar rat position at Burgundy Wine Company.
Which is, you know, to this day, one of the great
Still
wine stores.
One of the great small boutique shops
in Manhattan.
You got into
a good place.
Yep. Yeah. Al Hotchkin was my early mentor. I remember he looked at my resume and kind of looked at me like, why are you in here with a recommendation from Steve Tanzer? Right. So, yeah, that was a good connection. I was there for a few years and learned a lot because, Al and his partner, Jerry Tashjian, they used to serve lunch in the back of the store, and it was just basically the three of us, sometimes an extra person. But we would be back there, and he'd always go down to the cellar and bring something up in a brown paper bag and just pour it. And he basically said, yeah, blind. And he'd basically say, tell me about it. Now, of course, I figured it was Burgundy because that's all they sold at the time. But, learning Burgundy blind that way was a major building block for me in the early days. I'd grown up with parents who loved wine. Wine was on the table. But all I knew was if you were in college and you drank wine, it was a little cooler than beer. So eventually I started putting the knowledge together. Left Burgundy Wine Company, went to 21 Club. I was a cellar guy there for
another,
a little bit.
Very cool, legendary
great,
place.
Great place. And then my education continued there with classic Bordeaux, classic German Riesling, classic Tuscany, classic Cali Cab. The real, you know,
famous wine room, famous, wine cellar.
Yeah, the wine cellar used to give the tours with the secret key and open up the bank vault door down there. That was cool.
Right.
And then I bumped into an old colleague of mine who actually used to work at Burgundy Wine Company, Bruce Sanderson. He had gone on to work at Wine Spectator. He was running the tastings then in the, whatever that was, mid-90s, 96, 97. And he said, hey, so what are you doing? I said, well, I'm working nights and opening wine. And he said, well, how'd you like to work days and open wine? And I said, deal. So I got out of the
Sommelier. So Bruce was your connect to getting
into wine? Yeah, Bruce was my connection.
And Bruce is still there, right?
Bruce is still there. Yeah. Our offices are next door to each other.
Right. So
he brought me on board, and that was 97. And I started there as a tasting coordinator. I was basically doing the setting up the tastings for the other senior editors.
But you got a chance to taste,
and
too, right?
Yeah, at the end of the day, I would taste through everything and see how the tasters had written their notes and scores. And it was a total immersion on the job training. And after a few years, somebody left, and they said, okay, next man up. And that's basically the rest is history from there. So.
And that was?
So I started
in 97?
Yeah, I started in 97. I think I was officially tasting somewhere in the early, or 2000, somewhere
2000.
In there. Yeah.
Right.
And I think I started with Loire and South Africa, and then I moved to Chile and Argentina.
It's funny, Loire and South Africa probably back then were lower on
the
pole.
Yeah, they were really nothings.
Today, Loire, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah, Chile and Argentina were nothings.
Very happening places.
Yeah, I was just happy to dive in and do something.
All right, so we got you up to current and all that. Before we talk about wine and a little about the Wine Spectator, I wanted to get your take on a few things because I think you're in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you how social media and the internet has affected wine, and then take it to the next, step. And you're in traditional print in a way. I mean, even though they've expanded, is traditional print in danger? And then the third part, we could jump around. Are millennials affecting wine in any way that, you can see and describe?
Yeah.
So let's talk about social media first.
Yeah, social media. I mean, I'm a big fan of social media, and I'm also slightly wary of it at all times. I think you have to treat it with a little bit of respect because
what's the wary part?
Well, I mean, you're kind of wrestling an octopus in a phone booth with this thing that sometimes has great power, sometimes is easily abused, sometimes it's a mega time suck.
Right.
There's all these pros and cons to it. Yeah. And our business model is we give away our opinion for a price because we think it's worth something. Social media, a lot of times, is free. Yeah, and so sometimes you have to be careful of what you're giving away for free. I think, building brand awareness, making wine sexy, cool, fun, getting people interested is great. But ultimately, I think, writers, I think musicians, I think artists should all be paid for their work.
Right.
And we want to bring people to the magazine and our website, ultimately.
Right.
So learning that push-pull has been really interesting.
Any effect on print? I mean, a lot of magazines, legendary,
Yeah, I mean,
Glamour, Shutdown.
At the risk of sounding immodest, we, knock on wood, continue to do very well. Our readership is 3.5 million now, which I think is more than basically all the other guys added up.
It's great.
We are traditional print, but we are in a niche market, essentially, wine lifestyle. There isn't much else out there print-wise, in competition with us. But that notwithstanding, we can't just sit back and cruise. We got to make a good product, and I think we've worked very hard over the years to improve.
But
and
that may lead to the last thing that I asked you about millennials.
Yeah.
Your core reader is probably not a millennial. It's guys like you on the lower end and me, in the middle upper end that have, baby boomers, been around, collectors, a little disposable income.
Sure.
What happens when they all die?
We won't want that to happen anytime soon.
Right.
Women are a big part of our readership as well, which is...
Was that always, or it's moved into attracting?
No, I mean, don't quote me on this, because I'm not on the business side of the magazine. I don't know the numbers, but the readership of women, as far as I understand, has grown significantly. Millennials, this is a tough call. If we cater to millennials, then we're trying to be all things to all people. We would love for them to read our magazine, but we still have a sort of base... line of how we communicate a voice of the magazine, even though the individual editors are different. Would I like to bring millennials in? Absolutely. I think ultimately, as millennials, grow up and mature, or they move higher up the rungs in disposable income, they get more space.
It's a natural evolution.
I think there's a natural gravitation to that. Yeah,
I agree with that, and I agree that your wheelhouse is defined, and you can't deviate too much. One last thing, and it plays into all this stuff. Give me your take on natural wine and the natural wine movement.
I think anything that makes people interested about wine and gets them drinking wine is great.
Okay,
that notwithstanding, I do have, you know, beefs with the natural wine movement per se, in that it is a bit sort of reverse snobism, in that they have walled themselves off in regards to a style and a dogma and a belief that that in and of itself makes a wine better. The reality is there are good natural wines and there are bad natural wines. There are good wines that are grown organically and good wines that are grown sustainably, good wines that are grown conventionally, and bad wines from all those categories.
Right.
And if you sit there and say, just because the wine was done in this way, therefore it is better, I think you're adhering to a dogma that is cutting off a lot of other wine out there. And I see a lot of problems with the natural wine movement because there are people who would fit their definition who aren't in the club.
Right. There are winemakers that are legendary.
Winemakers that are legendary, but for some
reason, in Italy,
they don't get tagged with the natural wine label. They're not allowed to come to the party.
They do it anyway.
And I don't get it.
Yeah.
I like biodynamics, but it's not quantifiable.
Right.
I believe that anything that respects the land and puts the vineyard to the next generation in better condition than when you got it is great. But if you can't prove to me how it works, I'm going to question it.
Right.
And I think we need to question some of the things that the natural wine movement is saying.
I think that's a good take on it. I just wanted to see where you were at. All right, let's talk about what you do at Wine Spectator. You're the senior editor. You're a lead taster. I want to talk about two things. The tasting process, which I think is a big deal there and what you do. And, you know, you write. You know, I want to talk about how you develop stories. Tell everyone, let's go over the list again. What you cover, a specific list of regions.
Yeah, amongst the senior editors and other tasters at the magazine, we all specialize in specific regions.
Right.
It's not a tasting panel. There's not eight of us sitting around tasting one wine and averaging.
And there's about
our
a dozen of you.
Yeah. And we have an office in Napa and our office in New York. And so the team of editors basically has divvied up the wine world in various pieces. I'm covering, as you said, Bordeaux, Rhone Valley, California Cabernet. That's the vast majority of my work.
The Cali Cabs or
Cali
those
Cab,
three?
Those three together.
Okay,
add
and
up
the
to,
Cali Cab is a recent acquisition for you, right?
Correct. That came to my plate middle of this summer. So that's a big piece that has to get fit in. And then there's other little smaller regions, and I don't mean to give them short shrift, but just in terms of the category size, South Africa, port, as we discussed, Loire, things like that.
Yeah, volume and sales and interest coverage and all that. I mean, I
so yeah. So each editor has a specific region. All the reviews that are in the magazine are from blind tastings.
We
taste blind.
Okay.
Single blind. So we know appellation and vintage, but we don't know producer and price.
Okay.
And all those tastings, with the exception of Bordeaux, all the tastings are conducted in the office, either in New York or Napa.
Why is that? You make the trip to Bordeaux?
Yeah, for Bordeaux, for the en-primeur season, for instance, the barrel samples, I taste those in Bordeaux, but we collect the barrel samples and we taste at a neutral site with Wine Spectator staff. So I'm not reviewing wines based on going to the chateau and tasting with the winemaker in front of me.
Is that because Bordeaux is so big and vast, in order to taste out of the barrel, you got to go to them?
Yeah, and also, I mean, the logistics of shipping barrel samples to New York
right.
for an individual taste, that's just not something we want to deal
right,
with.
Right, right. There was just recently a tasting in New York for the 2016 board.
Yeah, the UGC comes through and they do their annual tour, and there was good buzz about that.
All right, so when you, I think people would be interested in this, when you sit down and taste a wine, so now we know it's blind in the bag, you know the vintage, you know it's going to be Bordeaux, Cali, or it could be from the Loire. What are the criteria that you use to judge wine? I'm sure everyone's are different.
Yeah, I mean, amongst the editors, I think we have a team concept. There's definitely a Wine Spectator approach.
Right.
But each editor obviously has their own take on it. I believe in my colleagues in that, you know, if Bruce Anderson gives a Burgundy 90 points, I'm going to be with him on that. The reality is if I taste the 20 wines he tastes, there's going to be some variability, but he knows the region far better than I am, and I'm going to defer to him. And I think, you know, that goes both ways. But in terms of criteria, I think we're looking for the same criteria that most people are looking for in wine. Typicity is something that we look for, complexity, you know, how does the wine fit in vis-a-vis all the other wines from that vintage, from that appellation, and then extrapolating further out other vintages and other regions. I think a California Syrah that rates 92 points should qualitatively be the same as a Rhone, a Northern Rhone that rates 92 points, even if they are completely different stylistically. And to me, that's a big part about tasting blind. It's quality first, style second. So there may be wines that I personally rate well that are not my personal style preference, but I have to tip my cap and say, that's a great wine in that style. And then conversely, I think, you know, there are wines in all styles that are not that great, and then we have to take
so the quality goes back to length, depth, complexity, all the things that make a wine
exactly
good.
Yeah,
they don't have to be similar, like you said, in
right Syrah. And granted, wine tasting or wine judging, wine critiquing is subjective, but we try to be as objective as possible, and that's right. Why we do the blind tasting.
So clear something up for me. You talked about Bruce tastes Burgundy. Does that mean you taste wines outside of your beat? Are you tasting Burgundies, or is just not enough?
Well, when Bruce is done at the end of the day and okay. I see what he's unbagged, it's
right.
nice to go over to his table sometimes.
Yeah. All right.
But no, I try to keep up on other things.
Yeah.
The reality is
you're in the biz.
I'm in the biz, and I like to taste a lot of different things, but Bordeaux, Rhone, Cali Cab, that keeps me pretty busy.
All right, so tell me this. You've been tasting Bordeaux for years. You just jumped on Cali Cabs. Mm-hmm. Tell me, are there distinct differences? You're talking about something that's been around hundreds of years, very nuanced, layered. You're
right.
talking about something that's still fighting, you know, for its reputation. Is it still ageable?
Right.
Are there differences?
Yeah, there's huge differences, which is what makes it so exciting. But there's also, you know, a lot of similarities between them as well. The argument that, for instance, Bordeaux has become homogenized or too ripe or in the warm, too many warm vintages, or it becomes too California-like. If you take a flight of Bordeaux from, let's say, 09.
A warm vintage?
A warm vintage with a lush, you know, fruit
right.
profile, and you put them next to a bunch of California
Similar?
Wines, Bordeaux tastes like Bordeaux. California Cabernet tastes like California Cabernet. They still stand apart very clearly. That's not to say there isn't an occasional California Cabernet that does a very good job of mimicking a Bordeaux and maybe vice versa. But the Venn diagram, the middle slice of that Venn diagram is very tiny. These are really two distinct categories.
So you said two things before, quality.
And style.
And style.
Yeah.
So the styles are different, for sure, which you just said.
Right.
The quality is good.
The quality is
good. The California quality.
Yeah, I have great respect for California Cabernet, and as I've gotten back into it officially for Wine Spectator, it's been nice to see just how good the wines are. You know, I kept light tabs on them over the years, but
right.
now that I'm diving back in, it's
right.
like, wow, you know, there's a lot of really good stuff here.
That's why it's great to taste the other wines. Cause when you jump in, you know, you have I was going to ask you this later, but let me ask you now, cause it makes sense. Would you agree that we're going through a period of restraint or dialing back? Ironically, when I wrote the question, I picked up the Times today and Eric Asimov talked about Chateau Neuf de Pops mm-hmm. kind of dialing back. Is that happening? Is that happening in Napa? Is it happening in the Rhone? Is Bordeaux?
You know, I'm always careful with these sweeping generalizations because for every producer that's dialing back, there's another one who's pushing the envelope. Are there general trends? Yes. I do think, I'll take it from the California Cabernet angle first. I do think after vintages like 97,
That's what Don Weaver called jumping the shark.
Yeah,
right?
that vintage did jump the shark.
It was big and bold,
super
and
big,
accessible.
Super bright, super rich. Some of the wines have not proven to have stood the test of time. I do think that there has been a conscious decision by producers to dial back. However, there are other factors in play, really important factors. And one of those in California Cabernet is the fact that much of that vineyard base has been replanted since phylloxera. And so in 97, and in that period, a lot of those vineyards were quite young, and they produced a fairly precocious, easy ripening, powerful fruit profile. Now that those vineyards have hit age 20, which is old by Napa Valley floor
right.
standards, those vineyards are a little more self-regulating. The viticulture has changed a little bit. There's a lot going on there rather than just winemakers sitting around a table saying, hey, let's dial it back.
Right.
It's not that simple.
That's sort of a natural.
Yeah.
In a young wine region, you're going to have young vines.
Right.
Now
and there's
starting
still also
to
plenty of new brands popping up in California Cabernet, where, you know, their first vintage out of the gate is a big blockbuster style. I mean, people are going to produce that.
Is this what people want? Or, I mean, are people tired of opulent over-the-top Cali cabs?
Yeah, I think some people
are. They looking
but I think
for
some
Bordeaux?
Love them.
Right.
I mean, I love Chablis. I love lean, minerally whites. And every now and then I go, you know what? I just want a nice oak bomb Chardonnay.
Buttery
Sorry,
oak,
but that's what
right.
I want. I mean, you know,
right.
And I think consumers probably are a little more open to that. I think you or I and other people who are really into wine from a professional angle probably dial down into our likes,
right,
and we get a little pigeonholed ourselves. I think the regular consumer is much broader, open approach to the wines they want to drink.
Yeah, you know, I cut my teeth on Cali cabs, yeah. And I still love them, but I'm kind of moving away and opening up.
Right,
you know, restraint isn't a bad thing and all of that. But I agree with you.
Yeah, and then you know you can extrapolate that to Bordeaux, where you know the garagiste movement of the mid '90s was the one they blew the doors off everything. And then what they did was they showed people, you know, maybe what's a little too far. But in doing that, they also really forced competition, especially from the left bank guys.
Right.
And those guys have really dialed down in terms of their vineyards, breaking them into smaller parcels and smaller vinification
right.
lots. And the finer detail is there. Now, is Pavé different from Figeac? Is different from Cheval Blanc? Of course. Some guys are still making a big glossy style, and some guys are doing something a little more elegant. But those are three great wines, qualitatively.
Right, yeah. Right. All good ones. So how many wines do you taste in about a year?
Actual formal reviews that get into the magazine is about 3,500 or 4,000. But in and above that, I wouldn't even know where to
double,
start
triple that? So you're saying yeah. 3,500 wines that you tasted, and you taste more, those work their way into stories or tasting list or ratings or whatever?
Well, no. For instance, I could go to a Domaine in the Rhone, and we could taste through his barrels or her barrels, you know, all afternoon. None of those wines are finished. Some of them may not even be assembled, blend, you know, that sort of stuff.
Got it.
That can really blow the numbers off the door. But like serious bottled finished
right.
wines, we're looking at 4,000 a year for reviews.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
All right, let's move over to the writing part. You know, you have a prominent position in the magazine pretty much every month. How do you develop your storylines? I mean, is it an assignment? Is it an inspiration? You know, is it a schedule? Like, you know, every November
we're doing Napa.
We
do have some things that are locked in, like the California Cabernet Report is always November 15th, so there's some things
okay.
that are regular.
So this coming November will be your first?
Yeah, this coming November 15th, this year will be my first
okay.
California Cabernet report. So so I've got work to do.
which means a lot of traveling back and forth.
Yeah, I'll be going back and forth from okay. from New York to California a lot. But, you know, there's a collaborative effort because we have annual meetings and we all work together and we bounce ideas off each other and try to come up with ideas and people that we think might be interesting features and so on. But then also, you know, the reality is when it comes to Bordeaux, I'm the one there, you know, deep in Bordeaux, and I have to write that vintage analysis every year. And so approaching that is something that I'm kind of on my own for versus a feature profile where I might go to my fellow editors and say, you know, help me get a storyline here.
Right.
You know, what's the angle? What do we want? Do we want to make it more business oriented? Do we want to make it more personal oriented? I mean, things like that
right.
are definitely part of the team approach at Spectator.
Do you have the opportunity from time to time where just the story seems so compelling to you, you could pitch
Yeah, there
it
are back. Times where the story writes itself, and there's sometimes where, okay, the assignment is write a profile on person A, and you're sitting there going, oh, man, like, I can't get my opening. Like, I don't have the quote I need.
Right.
Or I don't, you know, I need, I can't
Been
get
there.
Started here. And then sometimes they just write themselves, yeah.
Right.
I did a cover profile on Chateauneuf, and I went in thinking, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And then I went to Chateauneuf, and I asked a couple of the demands. I said, hey, how about we all go out to dinner? You all have your dads who made Chateauneuf, and you guys make Chateauneuf, so why don't you guys bring a bottle of wine from your dad's era and a bottle of wine that you made, and let's sit around and talk about it. And we had this fantastic dinner. It was about 3 hours long, stories around the table, et cetera, et cetera. And I got more color and quotes and things in the 3 hours talking to two generations from major domains. It was just, you know.
That's a great story.
It's a great way to get deep into the history. And at Wine Spectator, the mantra is very simple. It's educate and entertain. That's what we want to do for our readers.
Right.
Wine is a difficult thing, but it's also cool to learn about. And, you know, we're never all going to be experts. And I don't even think the experts are experts, because there's always another vintage. There's always it's just endless. So educating and entertaining is really what we want to do.
Did you walk out of there noticing a distinct difference between the generational wines, or?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Some guys carried on.
Yeah,
the march, other guys took their own.
Yeah, vinification techniques, who was using stems, who wasn't, things like that, that can really affect the wine, not to mention the blends, which leaned heavier and heavier to Grenache in more recent years, whereas in the past they had a higher percentage of the white varieties in the blends, and more Mourvèdre and more Sanso and Cunoise, things like that. Grenache wasn't as important 30 years ago as it is today.
Chateauneuf-du-Pape is the southern Rhone.
Correct.
There were great wines from the north, from the south. That's the classic southern Rhone.
Yep.
And the prominent grapes, and you could blend a lot of them, are what and how many? Don't list them all.
There's 13, right? Good. Thank you for not
the
putting me on the spot.
Three or four. You said Grenache.
Yeah, Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre are the three main reds, along with Cunoise, Sanso.
Right.
And then the whites are...
like Reyes makes 100%
Grenache,
and other guys.
You can make it from a blend, or you can make it from 100% of one varietal. Anywhere. You can make 100% Mourvèdre Chateauneuf if you wanted to.
Right.
Grenache is king now, though.
Right. So you've... I guess it's not like you've been tagged, but you've covered the big, bold reds of the world.
Yep.
You know, I would put Cali Cab there now.
For sure.
Certainly Bordeaux. The Rhone, North and South, are these, you know, very big, beefy wines. I think the Loire is, you know, maybe the exception there.
Yeah, the Loire's my breather wine.
Right.
Tasting all the
Shannon,
other stuff.
As Pascaline Lepeltier says, Shannon, Shannon, Shannon.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's take that break. Let's talk to my audience, and listen, you and I could sit here for 2 hours and just talk about Bordeaux or Cali or even the Loire. Let's talk about, you know, the beat that you cover. Let's talk about some interesting wine stories, winemakers, and keep value in mind, you know, that are interesting or fun or compelling or exciting to you. And, you know, we don't have to go on forever, but give me, you know, a few wines, regions, areas.
Well, one of the things when people ask me about the wines I taste for Spectator and how I can do different regions, I say, you know, the Rhone has my heart, Bordeaux has my respect.
Okay.
And now I got to find something to say about California, because I just got that. I got to weave that in. But, you know, the Rhone has my heart because that was the first major region I got at Spectator 15 some odd years ago. I think 02 was my first official vintage. And, of course, there's no reviews on any 02s because it was a washout.
Right.
So I had to wait for 03 to actually start.
You didn't hit the ground running. Yeah.
But there's something about the soul of the Rhone. It's small domains, family-owned and run. I'm sheepishly at the point where now I have seen the generational changes at many of these domains.
So that means, dinner you talked about.
Yeah, I'm dating myself at this point. But that, to me, they're soulful wines, because these are really, you know, not that this doesn't happen in other regions, it does often, but to me it's the definition of handmade, family, small, you know, focused, detailed winemaking.
So the North and South are very distinct.
Yep.
Grapes they use, style and all that. First question is, do you have a preference? Do you have a love?
That's a tough one. You know, every
does that
time
incriminate
I lean a
anybody?
Bit to Syrah, then I lean back a little bit.
So they're both great.
Yeah, they're both great, and that difference is what makes them great. But you know, for value, the Southern Rhone probably has the edge on the Northern Rhone. The Southern Rhone is much bigger. There's flatter terroirs that are
give
easier to work.
Give me some. You know, regions. Is it like Gigondas? Or?
Yeah, well, actually, I would start with a vintage. Right now, 2016 is probably the new benchmark vintage for the Southern Rhone.
Go into a store and look at Southern Rhone.
Go into a store.
I
never want to say you can buy any 16 or buy any wine from any vintage, but generally, 2016s are going to give you foolproof buying. And then the other key is you look for Côte de Rhone Village, from...
Which is Northern Rhone.
No, that's Southern Rhone.
That's Southern Rhone.
But you look for those from top Chateauneuf producers.
So it's like the table wine of the great guys. So in a right. good vintage with a good maker.
Exactly. So a domain like Saint-Prefer with a winemaker.
S-T-P-R-E-F-E-R-T.
Correct, yeah.
Give me one
more. Makes a Chateauneuf that's $50, $60, $70 a bottle. She also makes a Cote d'Aron that's $20 a bottle.
Okay.
It's the same grape, same vinification technique. The terroir is just outside the Appalachian border of Chateauneuf. So it doesn't have the name prestige. It doesn't have the hierarchy of that chutzpah of hierarchy, but it's a right. delicious wine. That's how you find value.
All right, so we're going to take a break in a minute, but before we do, and I have a few questions when we come back from the break, I want to subject you to our wine list. We'll taste a little wine. Let's give the Loire a little love.
Okay.
So tell me what you love and what's exciting about the Loire.
The Loire is probably like the hotbed for organic or biodynamic.
Right.
Viticulture, a lot of young domains that have popped up. And I would say it mirrors the Rhone in that small, family-run, hands-on, detail-oriented, probably more diverse than the Rhone in terms of its appellations. And it's, Chateauneuf has 13 varieties, but Chateauneuf is Chateauneuf.
Right.
Whereas you have just as much of an interesting melange of varieties from the Loire, which covers all the way from just west of Paris all the way out to the Atlantic and Muscadet. So again, 16 great vintage in the Loire. I'm just starting to taste some 17s. I'm not quite convinced that they have quite the zing or the
so
detail of 16.
The so 16 vintage is over where you want to be for now.
And yeah, I mean, the region is so broad; it's hard to dial down on any one producer. But Chenin Blanc from Vouvray, you have a number of producers.
Muscadet.
There. Yeah, Sancerre's and Puy Fumés are Sauvignon Blanc based. That's great stuff. And then you can get great Cab Franc.
Right.
And a vintage like 16, where there is some ripeness and it doesn't have quite the lean, leafy character that it usually has, I think
16's a good Cab Franc vintage.
Yeah, 16's are really nice.
Cool. All right. So, we're going to take a quick break. I'm talking to James Molesworth. James is the senior editor at Wine Spectator. When we come back, we're going to talk about a few more things. I'm going to subject James to our wine list. We'll take a little, take a few sips of some wines. And we'll take it from there. You're listening to The Grape Nation. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Cart Driver, Denver's home for wood-fired pizzas, fresh oysters, seasonal market plates, cocktails, and conversation. Tucked in a 640-square-foot shipping container space in the heart of Denver's Rhino neighborhood, Cart Driver is the perfect place to stop in for an Italian-style spritz, Prosecco on tap, and a wide variety of tinned fish. Open for lunch, dinner, community hour, and late night 7 days a week, Cart Driver is here for you with fresh, domestically sourced ingredients, and above all, hospitality. Learn more at cart-driver.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, James Molesworth. James is a senior editor at Wine Spectator. And James, I want to ask you about a few more things that you cover and you have the experience. Let's talk about port for a second.
Okay.
I was just in Portugal over the holidays.
Isn't it great?
I didn't realize that every port house is next to each other across.
I mean, it's just, you want to talk about a wine region where you can go for tourism and do
terrific.
Everything at once.
The whole country, Douro, port. We went to Alentejo. I mean, it's just a great wine place. All right. So, port recently celebrated some pretty good vintages?
Yeah, the 16 vintage ports. Again, that vintage keeps popping up, but the 16 vintage ports have just been released, and they're really spectacular.
So if you want to collect a little port, buy the 16 and lay them down?
Here's my thing for millennials. You may be 30, 35 now, maybe 27, whatever, and you're probably not thinking about the wines you want to drink in 25 years. But when I was 27, 28, 29, 30, the 97s came out, and I said, well, I better buy some of these because I don't know where I'm going to be in 30 years, but I'm going to figure that I probably want to drink some port. And I bought a few cases, and it was one of the smartest things I ever did because it is the wine that takes the longest to come around.
You got to think ahead, man.
So, I would encourage people to just, whatever your annual wine budget is, just kick a little bit to vintage port and put that stuff away, and you'll be really happy.
it resonated with my oldest son, Benjamin. You know, we were just sitting on the deck staring at port, smoking a cigar. Mm-hmm. And he's like, this is just unbelievable.
Yeah. No,
I can't drink this all day or to get hammered, but sitting here relaxing.
It's one of those wines, though, that you know, most people don't think of regularly, but then when they get a glass
why don't
they
we drink
they go,
more
why
port?
Don't we drink more port? Yeah.
Why? Just because it's misunderstood, heavy? Give me a quick explanation on that.
I think wine drinking in America is still relatively young. For all intents and purposes, barely two generations old.
Pretty much.
And I don't think, I think everything revolves around the main course on the table. The dessert culture, that sort of stuff, doesn't really exist here as strongly as it does in some other places. Nor does the length of the meal here exist the way it does in Europe. Nobody has a 3 or 4 hour lunch in the middle of the week, in the middle of the day.
Less and less now. Back to that millennial thing and all that, quick out.
Right, and I think port is anytime you're adding wines onto the back end of the meal, you're adding that much more time to savor and digest and relax and
which
talk.
Even plays for the sauternes and all that. People are just not as focused on that dessert wine.
And a sauterne is a great example too. Every time I pour a glass of sauterne for people, they go, man, this stuff is so good.
Why don't I drink more of it? It's just the perfect thing after a big meal.
Yeah, and I think we've got to break out of the, port with blue cheese and sauterne with foie gras. We do need to break away from those a little bit. Sauterne goes great with fresh oysters, and people always look at me funny when I say that, but trust me, I've tried it, and it's a great pairing. A little glass of port at 2 p.m. in between meals, especially on a winter day, sitting by the fire with a book. I mean, why not?
If you want to talk seasonal or weather, this is a perfect time.
Port is to winter what rosé is to summer. I do think you could drink them year-round, but for right now, it's snowing outside right now. I want some port.
I pulled you out on a tough day. I got you out of the office on a tough one, but it's clearing up now. I'll send you home in good weather. All right. After 16, any other good vintages in the decade?
11 is probably the current benchmark for vintage port. And then,
if you could find 11s.
You can find them. The secondary market for port, the prices tend to not increase that much. And you can find 85s and 94s and 97s.
Yeah, they're not crazy.
That are not crazy. They're essentially
Burgundy, let's say.
Yeah, sometimes even less than the current release price. And I would say, if you want to dip your toe in, you go to an auction. You find some 85, you get a couple bottles, you take those home and see, is this stuff that I really like? And then extrapolate forward, today's ports are much, much better than they were 25 years ago. So you're going to be getting even that much more than an 11 or a 16.
While I have you here, and I knew enough about it, but got a little deeper into it when I was in Portugal, just tell me why people should look at Tawny or Rubies versus the vintage port.
Well, Tawnies are cask aged.
Okay.
Whereas the Rubies, Ruby actually includes vintage port in that category because those are the ones that are bottle aged essentially.
Right.
So Tawnies, I think, are fantastic wines because they're cask aged. Sometimes they're blended. They're often non-vintage blends, like 10, 20, 30 year blends.
They'll be marked.
They're 10, marked.
20, yeah. 30, 40.
And then there are wines called Colheitas, which are basically vintage Tawnies. So there's a vintage year on them and it's a single harvested.
Right. So it's Tawny. Just the 85 or whatever.
Correct. Got it. So these wines are, obviously they're released when they're significantly old, a lot like traditional Rioja, for instance. So you're getting something that's ready to drink. They last.
Not cheap, right? You can find some.
You know, the 30 and 40 year olds, and the older ones, you're going to have to pay because of the rarity. But a good 10 year or 20 year Tawny is not that expensive. And they last a few weeks. So you open it up, you keep them in the fridge, you serve them a little chilled. And after that first 5 minutes in the glass, they're at perfect temperature.
Good for the winter, good for the holidays.
Yeah, great for an aperitif. I love Tawny port.
You like Tawny as much as vintage?
That's kind of like that's like Northern Rhone versus Southern Rhone.
But it's got you thinking. So there's serious consideration for both, which is fair.
If I can have a glass of both, I'll be happy.
So we just talked about port. Look for vintage port, 2016 being a good example. But also look at Tawnies. And like we said, there's 10, 20s, 30s, 40s.
Yeah, and I'm just going to give a plug again to go to Portugal. Everyone over there is basically fully bilingual, so you don't have to worry about speaking
incredible
Portuguese. It's absolutely gorgeous. It is really
hospitable.
Inexpensive. The food is fantastic.
The wines are.
And then when you're in Vila Nova de Gaia and Porto, the two towns right across the river, every single port house has their house there in a tasting room, and some of them have you know, wine bar, small.
And they're next to each other.
They're all next to each other.
It's like bar hopping.
It's bar hopping
like in college.
And it's
unbelievable.
It's just a fantastic experience.
I love that.
I had a great time there last summer.
All right. So quickly tell me, when you're not drinking wines on your beat, which we talked about a few times, what outside of the beat do you like?
Well, I still have a love of Burgundy.
Okay.
Which clearly goes back to
classic.
My first gig in the business. I still drink Riesling, though probably not as much as I used to, but I still have a bit of German Riesling in my cellar, which I love. I do drink California Rhone varietals, California Pinots, and California Chards. I like to keep tabs on that stuff.
While I have you here, give me a couple of things that are good or breakthrough to you or...
The kick I'm on lately is the Certas brand, C-E-R-I-T-A-S,
right.
which is a boutique-y
great Pinots,
Chardonnay
Pinot
producer on the Sonoma Coast. And I just, when I see those, I just grab whatever's on the shelf.
I just got on their mailing list.
All right,
so
kudos.
Grab whatever. Yeah. That's C-E-R-I-T-A-S.
Yeah, and I've just been loving those wines because they really have a freshness and a minerality that I love, but they don't skimp on fruit, and they're all, I don't know if they're all, but most of them are single vineyard bottlings. Extremely distinct. There's a house style, which I like, but each one has a very different expression, and I love when wineries do that.
Yeah, I'm starting to drink through them. Probably bring a bottle in soon, taste it on air. All right, we're going to subject you to our wine list. Our wine list is five questions. We ask the same five questions to everyone.
Uh-oh.
Don't overthink them. They're simple.
All right.
You can handle this.
Okay.
They're simple. Don't dwell on them. Let's move past them because we want to taste a little wine too.
Right.
So you may have answered this, but get a little more specific. What are you drinking now? Forget work. You know, what's in your fridge? What's on your table? What's interesting you? What are you drinking now? It could be seasonal.
There's always like three or four bottles of champagne in my fridge.
Okay. That's just the first time champagne came up.
Yeah.
Great wine.
I do love champagne.
How do you use it? For meals?
I use it, as a starter, and I'll use it as a late night finisher too when you still want something fresh and invigorating. I do tend to like, I've been gravitating to the drier styles.
Okay. You got a maker or two you love?
I mean, look, I'm not shy. I do like some of the, oh my God, the big houses. I like Ruinart. I like Krug. You know, I like brands and houses like that. But I do love
those are good guys.
Moët Noël Ledru. I do like Agropar at times. That Venus bottling from Agropar is a smoke show. Roederer is great. You know, Roederer's bio. Now that I think about this,
good example.
Roederer's are like a big house, right? So sometimes they don't get a lot of respect. They got the most, the largest biodynamic vineyard base in France. They can't get any respect from the natural wine crowd.
Right.
And the wines are terrific. And I don't understand.
There's the perfect example of somebody who's been doing it.
Yeah.
And just doesn't.
And Jean-Baptiste Lacan's a great guy. So, you know, but why would you not want to drink some of those wines?
All right. Those are good answers. And just to remind everyone, we're going to post James's answers on our social media so that you could look them up and try some of them. All right. Does James Molesworth have a favorite wine and food pairing? Is there something?
I'm only going to go here for this one time on radio because normally my stock answer is I don't play favorites. I try to be fair to everyone. I don't want people.
Wine and food pairing? Who are you playing favorites
with?
The chicken?
Because I am a part of the magazine. The magazine, I represent the magazine. The magazine comes first. So
okay.
I don't play favorites like, you know, I only like this style or only like that because I don't want to draw away
from. I didn't push you to that.
You didn't push
me.
But I will just say, if you give me a Rhone wine, north or south, with grilled lamb, I'm pretty much in heaven.
Okay. Yeah. So a nice, heavy Rhone. You said northern?
North or south.
Okay,
A Châteauneuf, a Cornas, a Cote Rôti, a Gigondas with lamb.
That's a great answer.
Done.
All right. I'm asking you this, and again, I don't want you to be inclusive, exclusive, incriminate, but do you have a favorite wine restaurant or bar? When you go out and you know somebody's going to do it well, has the service, the variety that you're comfortable at, are there places, you know, you're a New York-based guy.
Yeah, I mean, look, New York is an embarrassment of riches and when it comes to wine service and wine
great
lists.
Great people.
And
are you comfortable at some places?
I am. I mean, it's probably no secret from my social media that Nice Matin is kind of my canteen.
Right.
I think Aviram
is used
the wine
to live up there.
I used to live up there. Aviram does a terrific job. The wine list is deep in old vintages. Classics.
I think people in the neighborhood know that, but people outside of the neighborhood may not.
You know, it's a bit of a destination.
Next time you go to
downtown,
see a concert at the Beacon, perfect. Around the corner to Nice Spot. Yeah. Give me something else.
Porterhouse. I saw their list the other day, and they really beefed it up, and that place is killing it.
There.
Michael LaMonaco. I worked under Michael LaMonaco at 21 Club.
Was he at 21?
Yeah, 23, 24 years ago. So,
and he was the Windows on the World guy.
Windows on the guy.
Great sweetheart, right?
He's a super sweet guy, and I love to give him kudos. I think he's doing a great job. But, you know, there's a lot of great wine programs out there. I mean, the guys at the Grill and the Pool are doing a great job. Some of these places are expensive, so
right.
Where do you go for value? But, you know, Marseille in the Theater District, you know, they've got old Bandoles on the list.
Decent
there.
Wine
yeah,
list,
decent
Marseille?
Yeah, decent wine list, yeah.
And, that's a good one. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah. And,
great.
And I've been digging... Yeah, there's just, like I say, it's an embarrassment of riches. There's a lot of good wine directors around Manhattan.
All right, you don't have to answer it now, but right. When we wrap up the show, I'm going to ask you about your DJ career, and that encompasses another venue, too. All right, but let's finish this. I don't know if you can answer this, but you got to try.
All right.
Give me one, give me two. Do you have a favorite all-time wine? And I always say this, it doesn't have to be the rarest, the most expensive. It's become more experiential.
Right.
Is there something that,
well,
you
if
know,
we're talking experiences, there are certainly wines that, I'm not embarrassed to say, have literally brought a tear to my eye when I smelled them or
give me
drank
a couple.
There was a Magnum of 59 Margaux on the back porch of Margaux under the moonlight.
59 I mean, Margaux.
You know, that was kind of nice.
Now, I'm not a wine dummy, but I'm not an expert. Yeah. Was 59?
59 is pretty special.
It was a special year?
Yeah. Okay. And we had, I also had 45 Mouton from Magnum with Baroness Philippine when she
45,
was
45, I know.
Yeah, 45 is the legendary vintage. But, I mean, I've had some old vintages of Chav that are spectacular.
The Rhones.
You know, 74s from California. I've been lucky to have my account.
The Heights is
Magnum,
off the charts.
So those are, I guess, the classic.
That's exactly what I was looking for.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have to boil down to one answer. There were a couple of wines that were not cuts.
Yeah.
All right, last question, and I think you could handle this. I ask everyone, recommend your best wine around $15-$20 retail. And I'm looking for a red. I'm looking for a white.
Right.
I beat this line to a pulp. My kids are in their mid-late 20s. They're starting to make money. They're going to a party. They can't bring crappy wines.
Okay.
They're not spending $9. They're not spending $50. But what are they walking in that's cool for $15-$20?
Okay. Only because it's the first. This is like word association. So the first one that pops into my head is the Capburn Gascatone.
Wait,
which is the...
Say that again?
It's Capburn Gascatone. C-A-P-B-E-R-N, and then Gascatone. So I'm going to probably butcher this. G-A-S-Q-U-E-T-O-N, Gascatone.
From?
This is made by Caelan Segur. It's the property they own literally right
Caelan
across
Segur,
the street.
Bordeaux,
yeah,
Caelan
Segur,
famous.
Bordeaux.
Okay.
It's Cru Bourgeois. It's a large property. It retails for about $15 or $20.
Perfect.
And man, I'm telling you, it really delivers.
There's your red. I'll spell everything
not a,
out.
Not a 10-year ager, but just you want the Bordeaux profile in spades. It's just
a great one.
It's perfect.
Give me a white.
White. This one's going to be sneaky. It's probably about $20-$25 now, but so bear with me. But the white Cote de Rhone from Chateau Saint-Côme in Gigondas.
S-T-C-O-M.
S-T-C-O-S-M-E. Saint-Côme.
Côme. Cosme.
Cosme, yeah.
Okay.
So they make a white Cote de Rhone that's just a delight. It's got a lot of claret in it, which is a great grape.
Great value.
Yeah, great
I
value.
I think that's the first time anybody ever recommended that.
You know, white Rhones are sneaky. They're only about 4 or 5% of the production of the Rhone Valley, but they are some of the greatest white wines in the world, and nobody really knows that much about them, so you can get away with some great value with white Rhone.
Those are great ones, and like I said, we'll post them. Thomas, we got to wrap up the show, but before we wrap up, we're going to throw a little wine over the tongue. When you walked in, I handed you a glass of Rivers Marie, Thomas Brown's own project in California, Sonoma Coast 2014. What'd you think of it?
You handed it to me as I literally raced in.
I know you were late. You got stuck in traffic, but we did it.
We did it. You know, I would have guessed a little Burgundy. Actually, I mean, I was definitely in Pinot right away, but I thought Burgundy because it has that slightly smoky, perfumey sandalwood aspect to it. Little herbaceous, little wood spice. Not a super fruit bomb, but it's
somewhat of
some
a compliment.
Fruit. Yeah,
you know, for a Cali. All right,
the freshness is there. It's nice wine.
Okay. Let's quickly talk about the wine that you brought in.
Okay.
I ask all my guests if they'd like to bring in a wine. We'll quickly taste on air and evaluate. Every week we taste a different wine on air for our weekly wine sip this week. James brought in a Helen Keplinger.
Yeah, Keplinger. So I wanted to bring in something that was not for my beats, but connected in a way. So this is her White Rhone blend.
Not from your beats means you don't cover.
Yeah, I don't
Shard.
Officially cover this. So right. I can
cover California, but
I can
not
take
Shard.
My critic hat off. And
I like
this
that.
Is what
go
I
out of your box and comfort zone. Go ahead.
Yeah. So this is her El Dorado is the name of the cuvee. It's the 2015
under the Helen Keplinger label.
Under the Keplinger label. And it's a blend of, I'm looking back, Viognier, Roussan, and Grenache Blanc. So those are three grapes that I love.
It's a Rhone.
It's a White Rhone blend. Yep, the ABA is the Sierra.
All right, so let's evaluate it. Color-wise, you got that, kind of nice yellow. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the nose quickly.
I like it because it's a mix of tropical and orchard fruits. So it kind of hints that it's going to be opulent, but there's a freshness there, too. There's some honeysuckle and some jasmine notes that give it a little zing.
Is that the nose or the palate?
On the nose.
Okay.
And I think that follows through on the palate. There's a juicy richness in the middle.
But let's go mouthfeel first. It's a pretty...
It's not shy. I'll give you that. No. It's a fruit-driven wine.
Yeah. I mean, it's got a full mouthfeel.
Right. But just as you think, like, this might loll off, it actually has a little blast of detail at the end there, a little floral lift, a little freshness.
So give me the palate.
Palate to me is a bit of melon, a bit of green almond, a bit of yellow apple. And then at the end, you get a little star fruit and acacia and some zing to it, which I like.
There's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on
there. The green almond is what, a little bitter?
Yeah, a little bitter in that little...
people say, what's he talking about?
Yeah, a little pithy, high-pitched note to it that offsets the base elements of the apple and the melon.
All right, so tell me what we would pair this with. It's good pairing.
It's hard not to drink it on its own, but I would do that with some seafood.
Good point. What kind of seafood? Oily fish?
No, I would do...
Shellfish?
I would do some shellfish. I would do some just basic shrimp. Lobster tail would be nice.
Lobster,
langoustine, something like that.
Perfect.
I think wine and food obviously is why we drink wine. We want to match it with food, but I really try not to overthink that stuff. I just keep it simple.
Yeah, I agree with you. We like this wine. We love this wine.
I love this wine. I mean, this was from my cellar. You said bring something. And
give me, if you can, your best guesstimate retail.
Her wines are in the $50 to $70 range on her.
She's a small producer. She's a bit of a rock star out there. She has some cool projects.
Yeah,
we're talking quality here, and pretty good value.
Yeah, she worked with Grace Family and Don Bryant, and she earned her chops out in Spain, and now she's back doing her own thing with Keplinger. And
it's a special wine, you're going to pay a few bucks. Yeah. We gave you the $15, $20 wines. All right, James, we got to wrap up the show. I got to get you out of here. We got another show coming in.
Okay.
If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us at Instagram at SBenRuby, but follow the hashtag The Grape Nation on Twitter or at BenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. We ask you to subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify. I think we're on Pandora now. Like I said, I will post James' wine list answers, and I will give you more information on our weekly wine sip and the other wine that we tried. James, if we want to find you on social media and Wine Spectator, because you're kind of connected at the hips, let's do each one.
Yeah, no, I work for Wine Spectator 100%. So winespectator.com is our website. Obviously, the
very rich
is out there.
Site.
A lot going on there. And then I'm
free
on,
and paid.
Free and paid content. And then I'm on social media. Instagram is my main jam. It's jmolesworth1 on Instagram. And I also tweet, but I think Instagram is...
Same thing, right? James Molesworth.
J. Molesworth 1, yeah.
And, I've been following you lately, and there's a lot of great stuff. There's a lot of individual wines with detail. I assume things that tickle your fancy at the time or, what's going on with the gig.
Yeah.
I mean, besides trying to extend what you're doing, there's a lot of, great information.
The idea is to make wine... cool and fun, and there's a visual component to that, and I think Instagram is great, and I work with the Venom Collective, which is a two-person group, Michelle and Vanessa, who help create some content for me, and then there's my content as well, and I think it's been working, and it's been a lot of fun.
I think it's been great. All right, I want to thank our guest, James Molesworth. James is the senior editor at Wine Spectator magazine. I want to thank our engineers. We got Maddie P. in the box tonight. And I want to thank everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family and become a member. Thanks for listening.